Welcome to Pour and Tell. I'm your host, John the Cigar Surgeon McTavish, here as always with my co-host, June Liu. Live, no, we're not live, we're pre-recorded, but we're available at developingpalates.com. Yeah, what do we got this week? June, how's your week going?
Week's good. I don't know what it is up there, but like, I think you guys are still getting into a lot of cold weather, but over here, everything is blooming right now, all the trees and flowers and all that. And I'm getting ridiculous allergies, dude.
Like, same. My allergies. Oh. Yeah, we were actually in the high 60s, low 70s. And then out of nowhere, because this is how April and May work up here, we got a snowstorm. I'm actually looking out my window right now. We've got, I don't know, half a foot of snow, which will be gone by next week because middle of the week, we're supposed to be, again, back in the mid to high 60s. And I think by next weekend, we'll maybe even in the low 70s. But, you know, that's... That's why sometimes it's tough for me to get in reviews. I mean, it's great with libation reviews because I don't need to go sit on my deck, which is nice.
Yeah. No, it's really, you know, it's I don't have a lot of complaints living in, you know, Barrie, California, but like the weather's really nice, vast majority of the year. But and it's really nice to like have all the flower bloom and, you know, see all that change. But you know, it's just personal first world problems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't enjoy. I'm like I said, I'm pretty stuffed up right now. Geeky nose coverings last night because otherwise my wife would have murdered me in my sleep from the snoring. So this is the and it doesn't help if I have a whiskey before bed. Oh boy.
Oh man. Oh, boy. Snore City.
So this week in the Pour and Tell segment, I'm gonna do a throwback to review it a couple weeks ago. It was a Dark Horse Sour from Fernie Brewing Company. And it's kind of a, you know, it's kind of an interesting sour. Some of the sour beers that I've had before, I'd say almost consistently are kind of the color of mead, where they're sort of that yellow, almost a pilsner color. And this was quite dark. I mean, if you looked at it, you'd think it was either a lambic or, gosh, even maybe a brown ale. Like, it was really quite dark. But what was nice about it is, again, talking about something being sessionable, this was only 5% ABV, so that's kind of nice because sours have been creeping up. And to me, it, you know, the risk with something that dark is I didn't want to get into lambic territory, and I didn't think that it did. It had some sweetness, it had some fruit quality, but those were accent notes to the primary taste, which was the sour. And I wouldn't say it was the like most, you know, flavor crushing sour that was out there. It wasn't average. It wasn't amazing. It was kind of somewhere in between. So it was enjoyable. It was interesting. It moved the dial. I ended up rating it a 6.33, which is, kind of in the, you know, middle good category for our review scale. And I would definitely crack that again for sure.
Is this is it a fruited sour? No, right?
It is. Yeah. They use, I think they use blackberry. It's either blackberry or currants. And, you know, again, I was, because I think whenever you add a adjunct, that the risk is that takes the primary flavor away from whatever style you're trying to brew. And that wasn't the case here. It absolutely had primary sour flavors. And then, you know, there was a little bit of sweetness from the adjuncts. And then interestingly, some toasted barley, like that, you know, that like really husky barley, oaty flavor, like not like oatmeal, but like that, you know, barley husk came through to kind of give you that cereal flavor at the end of the palate, which was interesting. And like I said, you know, not amazing, but certainly well in our category of good.
Yeah.
So
what was the price point of that?
It wasn't that bad Canadian wise. I think converted to US dollars, I think it worked because it's a tall bottle. So, and I hate tall bottles because I have to finish the whole thing.
Yeah. It's a commitment.
Yeah. It's a commitment, but I think it worked out to about $4.30. American per bottle.
Okay. Wow, that's cheap.
Not bad. I mean, there's certainly beers that I've paid $7-$8 American or more for a tall boy. So
nice.
You had an interesting week. You got your first whiskey review.
Yeah. So getting in the swing of the Pour and Tell and our DPs kind of libations kind of swing of things. So yeah, I did my first review. I chose. So, by the way, for people that are listening, so we don't get any of this stuff, you know, like, you know, companies don't send us whiskey or beer. So this is all sourced from us.
Well, now that you've said that, just an asterisk there. I do actually have at least one review coming up where I was sourced from the brewery, but more because the experience I had was the beer that I bought was considerably outside of sort of the calendar of fresh. And so the brewery kind of sought to replace that, which was kind of nice. But yeah, we're not getting samples.
Oh, so I guess in order to get free stuff, I need to go buy some like really old ass IPA and then like bitch about it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't call it free because, you know, I was on the hook for this initial bottle that I bought, which ended up being not great. And, you know, obviously buyer beware, you got to make sure to check that that brew date. Very important. Anyways, no, for sure. Sort of distract.
So my first review that's currently up is Nika. So it's the Nika whiskey from the barrel. So this is a barrel strength, so cask strength whiskey that came out of Japan. So so this particular bottle, you used to only be able to pick it up internationally. But ever since like the summer of last year, they released it to the U.S. There's a lot to like about this. I mean, off the bat, I mean, I scored the sucker 8.17, which it's high.
That's high. Like,
I mean, so reminding the viewers within our overall, the way you want to think about it, our scoring system is it's 0 to 10, 10-point scale, and you want to think of it as like taking a consumer survey, right? If you score something 5, you're moderately satisfied. If you score a 10, you are perfectly satisfied, right? So that's kind of like overall how you want to think about it. So if you score something that's like in the low 8s, you're mighty satisfied about the experience. So yeah, that was me. So given the fact that, you know, flavor and overall essentially accounts for like, I think close to 70% of our total score, I mean, I rated the flavor to be very good as well as overall to be very good. So the only thing that I honestly wasn't all that pleased, which doesn't really matter that much, it's only, you know, accounting for 5% of our score. And I rated the appearance to be average because it was like kind of like that light amber kind of a look. Whereas, you know, when I think about most barrel, like barrel proof whiskeys in the bottle, there's definitely more color added to it, right? Because you're not diluting it out of the cask. But doesn't really matter because this thing's delicious. It's basically for fans that enjoy nuance, complexities, balance of most Japanese whiskeys out there. You're taking it straight out of the barrel, right? And you get to finally taste the cask strength version of it, which is awesome. $65 for all this.
That's not bad.
No, not at all. I mean, especially now within how Japanese whiskey is priced now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, even like, Scotch whiskey. I mean, most good minimum bottles, you're well over $100 easily.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's almost like if you don't have $100 in your pocket to buy a tasty bottle of Scotch, you might as well not even buy Scotch. Go buy some bourbon. Yeah. You know.
No, 100%. Absolutely agree with that.
But yeah, I loved it. It has all the right characters, man. I mean, you got the right wood, smoke, sweetness, spice, fruit. It really is just well packaged together. Within any of these notes, like, you know, the difference between something buying a $65 bottle of Japanese whiskey and having all these, you know, the main points and the main flavors hit well versus something that you're going to spend like $300 Japanese whiskey. Those other bottles will give you more depths of all of these notes. But again, like I said, within $65, man, like in a heartbeat, you know, this is a stalker. I mean, I got 4 or 5 bottles of stuff. I know I'm a freaking hoarder. You know,
minor hoarder.
Yeah.
Nice. No. That sounds pretty good. So that's all we have this week in the Pour and Tell segment. So moving on to libation news, some interesting things.
Oh, actually,
hang on. Hold up.
I wanted to talk about what we've been drinking.
Have you been drinking?
What I've been drinking as well.
What have you been drinking?
So I actually just did this last night. So went on a little mini date with a girlfriend, and we went to this like modern Vietnamese restaurant called Slanted Door. The restaurant itself.
Racist.
Yeah, I know. There's actually cultural significance to it instead of what you really think. Because no, I when I first heard it, I was like, this racist motherfucker. This is probably some like non-Asian dude that opened this shit.
Yeah, better hope that owner's
But
Vietnamese or shit's coming down on his shoulders, I'll tell you what.
the owner is a rich freaking Vietnamese
Good
dude.
for him.
It's actually a Michelin star rated restaurant.
Damn.
We went in there mainly for like some light apps. And they have a pretty good drink menu. What's interesting about this restaurant is they have a sister whiskey bar called Hard Water. That's at San Francisco, like Embarcadero area. And Hard Water is a amazing, mainly American whiskey bourbon bar. So you're gonna find like old Dusties from like 76, like 70s to
Wow.
all the limited editions. One of the cool things that this bar does is they really enjoy going, over to Kentucky and picking their own
I
barrels.
mean, June, who doesn't enjoy going to a distillery and picking your own barrel and sampling a half a dozen or a dozen barrels and going, "No, this one's no good. Let's try another barrel."
Yeah,
Sign
and
me
by the
up.
time you get all slosh, you're like, yeah, let's just buy all these barrels. So within one of the barrels that I tasted, so I had a bourbon from Buffalo Trace
Big
Distillery.
fan.
The bourbon itself is called Old Weller Antique. It's very well known among especially bourbon fans. It's one of those things where like people kind of like freak out about. They really enjoy Buffalo Trace in general. Old Weller and Antique in general is getting a lot harder, harder to find. But this restaurant was selling 1.5 ounce pours for $11, and I said, "Absolutely, give me a pour."
100%.
I love this drink because, bourbon in general, I feel like, people really love it because, excuse me, first of all, it's approachable, right? In terms of budget, in terms of like overall flavor
He's
profile.
giving me tons of work in post on this episode, I tell you
Oh.
what.
All right.
Do you wanna use the mute button? No, that's fine.
Hold
I
on.
like I like post production. That's my favorite part of the doing a podcast, post production. The best. Just sit for hours and have my stupid voice editing stuff out.
I think I'm okay.
Sorry.
Anyways, Old Weller Antique is something. Old Weller Antique is something that's enjoyed quite a bit by a lot of bourbon fans. A lot of vanilla, toffee, 107 proof. So you definitely get more of the barrel, as is barrel characteristics, I like to call. And it was awesome. Now between their barrel pick versus like a regular Old Weller
Right.
Antique. That's always really interesting. I've had such a disparity within barrel picks within Old Weller Antique. Something that can range from like stuff that's tasting a lot spicier. It's mainly, I feel like, the spice component, right? Between barrel to barrel within this. It's like, do you get more of that earthy spiciness or like herb spiciness versus not? Whereas this barrel, it was definitely more spice than not. But I really enjoyed it. And I'll definitely be back and drink more.
Yeah, I mean that's why I kind of fall in love with barrel picks is because this is really the true thing is that you're getting a spirit that's reminiscent of the distillery that it's coming from, but unlike anything else you've had from the distillery. And there's definitely good and bad. I mean, I've had certainly samples where I went, this tastes like lavender, not really my thing. And then you have one that comes along and you're like, this is the most magical. Magical heaven rainwater I've ever tasted. And so, that's, but obviously if you're paying up front, I'm not sure that I would be keen on dropping barrel pick kind of prices if I wasn't able to sample first. Sampling, I think in this case, that's going to be the key for me to drop that kind of coin on something.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's oftentimes getting really hard to sample and then buy
Yeah.
because with these kind of releases, it's gotten so vastly popular
It's
that
gone.
once it's a release, it's immediately
Yeah,
snatched up,
people
right?
are buying. I mean, you were talking about, having four bottles and being a collector. Well, I mean, I know plenty of guys, and I wish, you know, they were better friends, because they buy by the case, right? So I'm like, yeah, dude, you bought a case of bourbon or, you know, scotch? And it's like, yeah, I always buy by the case because, you know, I don't want to run out, or, you know, secondary market or whatever. And it's, man, like, you're dropping, what, a grandy on a case? Yeah. Like, man, I like to play, but that's a little rich for my blood.
Yeah, I'm not Mr. Jones over here.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And that's
cool, it. Cool, man. So getting into libation nudes, something that's kind of exciting for me, Glenmorangie has always been kind of, because obviously we are cigar reviewers, and one of the things that I really enjoy pairing with cigars when I have the opportunity, when I'm not doing Rebecca, all I do these days is reviews.
Yeah, real problems. Review life. We're gonna get shirts like that and wear it around the trade show.
Absolutely. But the Glenmorangie has a series of barrel finishes that they do, and I've found that they pair really, really nicely with a very wide range of cigars. So one of the kind of mainstays was the Quinta Ruban port finish. Now, there's people who will say, you know, port finish is kind of cheating, because quite frankly, it's too easy. But for the money, I think the bottles are only, I want to say $64-$68 Canadian, so quite reasonable. They had an age statement, which you don't necessarily see. In fact, I would say a lot of barrel finish stuff this day, the barrel finish is to kind of make up for the roughness of the spirit, because it's not an age statement spirit. Now, it's always been 12 years, and quite frankly, it's affordable, it's good, I enjoy it. I don't know what's going on, but they've decided that they're going to eliminate the 12 year, and you're thinking, oh man, they're going down to 10 year, they're going down to no age statement. Nope. They're going the other direction. They're like, well, we want to really focus on flavor, so we're going to go up to a 14 year. Now, it doesn't really say whether the price is going to change, but I get the impression that they're just going to offer it at the same price because their stocks are healthy. Their customers have been making that demand, and you know, they feel that the flavor really pops in the 14 year versus the 12 year. So, I mean, at a time where, you know, a lot of distilleries are running out of inventory and they're kind of moving to the no age statement or younger age statement stock, I'm pretty cool. So this kind of really follows a trend that originally in the mid-2000s, they had no age statement Finnish whiskeys. They moved it up to age statement Finnish whiskeys kind of 2010-ish. And now they're increasing the age statement. So they're kind of bucking the industry trend, which is cool. I mean, you know, they already had my support. Now they have more of my support. So I think that's kind of cool.
You want to get more support. Yeah. So I was just doing a little Googling, and looks like the same price as the 12. So
no brand.
45 euros. You know.
Sounds like we're going to have to crush a couple of bottles in Vegas.
Yeah. Too bad I'm not going.
Sad.
Anyways, move on. Panda.
What do you got going on? You got some interesting libation news this week, which is going to lead to an interesting conversation.
Yeah, so this is back in late March, San Francisco World Spirits Competition. So this one, within spirits competitions out there, this one gets quite a buzz because mainly because it's positioned as something that's no bullshit. We tell you how it is. Like how it is to like regular consumers without the fancy magazine, you know, advertisements and whatever behind it, right? So within this year's San Francisco World Spirits Competition, the winner is a bourbon, and specifically it is a bourbon out of Heaven Hill in Kentucky called Henry McKenna. So Henry McKenna is a it's basically like an average Joe's bourbon, right? Like it's positioned as like $35 a bottle or so. It is tasty. I've had many bottles of Henry McKenna, but the reality of Henry McKenna is they're single barrels, right? So
you're getting maximum flavor from the bourbon.
Yeah, so like single barrels, you know, the bottle is great because it tells you that it's like bottled in bond. It's they tell you the barrel number, right? And they tell you the exact date it was barreled on, right? And since it's 10 years, so all Henry McKenna has aged 10 years. So, you know, the barreled on date is important because you just count 10 years after the bottling.
I mean, that's pretty impressive because aged bourbon, there's a lot of distilleries out there that just don't do age statement, or if they do an age statement, it's pretty minor, like 3 to 6 years.
Yeah. So, in general, I really enjoy that about bourbon industry is, you know, it's I feel like it's a lot more transparent within the information they give us. And there's a lot more rules behind it as well. And at some point in one of the episodes, you know, we could kind of go through like how to, you know, the bourbon and how to read the labels and kind of like what to look for, absolutely. I guess. So, you know, given that it's bottled in bond, it'll always be 50% alcohol by volume, 100 proof, right? So that's the nature of bottled in bond. So with all that said, it's a very good bourbon. It is one of those bourbons in which, like, you know, for me, when I get a guy in the bourbon, you know, I originally tell them to buy things like a bunch of like 90 proof stuff, right, to kind of get their palate acclimated to just kind of alcohol and burn and sting. And once they kind of graduate from that, this is exactly the bottle that I always tell people to get, because you basically up level in terms of flavor, wanting the flavor profile of bourbon, as well as increasing that alcohol volume so that you get more of that barrel. So a lot of people are really upset about this because Henry McKenna being single barrel, the likelihood of you finding this barrel number, I think it's barrel number 4976, right? Barreled in like April 7th, 2008. So you have to go out there and find this exact one barrel to see what the panel has voted as the whiskey of the year.
Yeah, so for listeners who are unfamiliar with what a barrel statement or an individual barrel bottling is, that means that, like, typically when you get bourbon or you get whiskey, scotch, the whiskey is vatted together from a number of different barrels. It could be 10 barrels, it could be 20 barrels, you know, different ages to combine to get you what is a consistent final product. The reason that barrel statements are so exciting is because you're getting one barrel, whatever it is. It could be great, not great, it could be the most amazing thing ever. The problem is, as June is alluding to, once they bottle that, you can't reproduce that. It is a unique whiskey that is limited to, I assume, in this case, is probably only 600 or 700 bottles, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a lot of inventory, especially, you know, when you talk about winning a competition like that. I mean, that inventory is probably long gone.
Yeah, and it's also interesting because, so I think in one facet, people are basically saying, I can't find this shit. Like, you're telling me this is a whiskey year, I can't basically go out and buy it and try it for myself, right? And another thing is, you know, Henry McKenna has always been, for a very long time, one of those, you know, bourbons in which a lot of bourbon enthusiasts talk about, in which they don't want to tell to the masses that it's good bourbon, uh-huh, right? Because they don't want to deviate from that $35 price range.
Well, and I'm sure, additionally, they are very happy about being able to go into their local bottle store and pick it off the shelf and nobody knows what it is, right? So there's definitely some selfishness going on there.
it's primarily selfishness, including on my end. Because when I heard about this, you know, I was like, well, fuck that. I ain't not drinking Henry McKenna anymore. and you know, so there's another aspect of that. You know what's interesting about this particular brand is I remember being at like a big box store, box liquor store, like I think it was like last summer, and one of the sales associates came to me because they always like come up to me like I'm, you know, like I don't know anything, and they always trying to like sales pitch. And there's a multiple times when I went to that store, they're just kind of like this the guys will try to sales pitch Henry McKenna, and they're like, and the way they sales pitched it was, hey, make sure you pick this stuff up, it's gonna go up in price. That's how they sales pitched it. And I was like, dude, look, like, you know, and I even was like, look, chill, man. Like, all these freaking hoarders and collectors out there, they're going to come in and they're going to ask you for the limited editions that come out, the one and done stuff, right? The Pappies and whatever, right? I was like, I'm cool, dude. I'm cool with having to buy a bottle of Henry McKenna when my one bottle of Henry McKenna at home is emptied. So totally eat my words.
Yeah, don't you have egg on your face now?
Yeah,
they're just trying to look out for you, and you gotta slag the poor sales guys at the bottle shop, man.
I know, and then like, and I even had I had a coupon back there, and I was able to pick this up for like $30 a bottle. So,
You never know, but, though, right? Like, there's plenty of times, like, there's plenty of Scotch whiskeys that are still 5-10 years later under the radar. Arran, Springbank, you know, there's Kilhoman. Like, these are all whiskeys that are very good whiskeys and very undervalued in the market compared to, like, what they should be charging. So, for all you know, it could have carried on for another 5-10 years and no one would have been the wiser.
That's true. I mean, dude, it's not like within this huge boom of bourbon the last few years, it's not like the companies out there, distilleries out there, they're like, let's cut back production. No, of course not. They're going to increase production. Absolutely. Like, you just need time to, to catch up to when the barrels are ready to drink.
It's tough, man. I mean, I can't imagine having to be responsible for spending millions of dollars 3 years in advance because you got to wait 3 years to bottle this stuff.
Right.
I mean, that's, boy, even if you have a lot of money to play with, you don't know what the, I mean, this is, if you follow the history of whiskey around the world, the history of whiskey is the history of economics around the world. There's booms and busts, and you really don't want to be the guy who's holding on to tens of millions of dollars in inventory that is depreciated now that 3 years is up. Cause you got to pay the bank, man. Like, They take their money, or if you have investors, they're expecting a return on that investment. And I mean, that's the kind of stuff, I mean, not at that size, but if you're a larger distillery, that's the kind of stuff that can shutter a distillery.
Yeah, for sure. So absolutely.
Cool news, man.
But I mean, take it as you guys will. Personal recommendation, I would spend up to $40-$45 to get a bottle of this stuff. It's good. You guys should go pick it up. I don't care if you're seasoned bourbon guy or new bourbon guy. It's a great bottle.
Sounds like we need to add a hot buy segment to Pour and Tell. This week's hot buy, Henry McKenna. All the hipsters out there are cursing out June. Get it while you can. Get it while you can.
Yeah, I'll just go buy a bunch for myself and then we'll release those segments.
Secondary market, baby. It's all about the secondary market.
That's right.
All right. Well, thanks very much for tuning into this week's episode of Pour and Tell. We'll be back in 2 weeks as per our normal show schedule. If you have any questions, feedback, or just want to call us dumb, you can find all our contact information at developingpalates.com. You have to know how to spell palate, though. Good luck using the dictionary. Tip a glass. We'll see you in a couple weeks.